We present My Word. A panel game devised by Tony Schran and Edward J. Mason. And here to introduce the teams is John Julius Knox.
Thank you. Our teams for this week are Dilys Powell, Antonia Fraser, Frank Muir and Dennis Norden. We start off with a round of English dialect words from the highly expressive vocabulary of English country people. Did you say something?
I said aye.
Can you, Frank, from the sound of it, guess the meaning, assuming you don't know it already, which you probably do, of the following dialect word? Mubble fubbles.
My experience of dialect words, speaking as one whose Bible is Halliwell's Provincial Dictionary of Dialects, is that all words like mubble fubble are either depression or they are disturbance of the bowels.
For which will you plump?
Which
darling.
Well, 50%. I think it's an upset tum.
Too bad. It was the other one. It's a depression of the spirits, a feeling of gloom. Antonia, a gongoozler.
If it's anything about cricket, then I won't be immediately excellent interpreter. Are you sure it's not a Somerset description of a cider party following the last match of the season?
It's an awfully good idea. It's not, though. I'll give you a hint. It's a person.
I think I was getting
that. What does that person do?
Ah, some kind of...
Is he a chancer? Is he a gongoozler? Is he a chancer?
A chancer? No, he's not. I don't think you're going to get it, you know. I'm awfully sorry. I'll tell you what it is. It means an idle, inquisitive, unhelpful spectator. It's up to a point perhaps like a kibitzer. Only kibitzers perhaps try even harder. Dilys, a Strabble Bob.
That's an insect.
Yes, it is.
It's an insect. Strabble Bob. A cricket. No?
Not quite. What things straddle things? What do you have in order to straddle something?
Long legs. Daddy long legs.
A daddy long legs is right. You had a very little help from your friends. I'll give you 1.5. Dennis, a verb or doing word.
Yes.
To hobgoble.
Hobgoble. It's like, what's that word, hobnob? It would be a countryman who mixes with cockneys who come up at the weekends. Or to mix, if it's a verb, to mix with visiting cockneys. To hobnob with the goblimeys. It would be to hobgoble. With, you know, he's, and you'd be rather looked down on in
Gorble.
The pub.
Glasgow,
sure. Oh, right, then it could be Glaswegians, to any visiting Glaswegians you get into. If Billy Connolly plays a concert down there and you have a drink with him, you would be hobgobbling.
He is trying awfully hard, isn't he?
Or being very tired.
He's absolutely wrong, but... What it actually means is to putter about in a feckless, ineffectual sort of way. Anyway, there we are. And so, before we go into round two, Frank and Dennis, here are the quotations that you were given for the last round. Frank, your quotation is that well-known saw, one good turn deserves another. And Dennis, yours, I promised you I wouldn't sing, so I won't. Little brown jug, how I love thee. And so we come on to a round of origins and derivations. What was the origin of the following word or phrase, or from what did it derive? Frank, to do good by stealth.
What's the origin?
I'll give you a clue. It comes from literature.
Charles Lamb,
thought that that happiness was doing good by stealth and having it found out by accident.
Yes, quite right.
Which I totally agree with. But I think it's an I think he was echoing Pope's thing, wasn't he? About Ralph Allen. Do good by stealth and blush to find it fame.
You're perfectly right, and you got that it was Ralph Allen. You also were able to put in an extremely apposite quotation from Charles Lamb, so I shall give you 3 marks. The most admirable answer.
Somehow makes it all worthwhile.
Antonio, can you tell me the origin or the derivation of the word fascinating?
Well, does it come from those things held up before the Roman consuls, the fasces? No? Oh, dear.
I don't know. Is it one of those words that's changed its meaning?
Yes.
What, to put an evil spell on?
Yes, to put an evil spell on is right.
Because that's what Frank now is putting on.
But he's doing it with remarkable success.
Yes.
Just as you're answering the question. You're perfectly right. It did actually mean submitting to the evil eye, submitting to a spell cast by a witch. And then later to paralyzing effects exercised on birds and small animals by people like stoats and snakes and owls and people who hypnotize smaller people. Dillis, like a giant refreshed.
Like a giant refreshed. The Bible.
Yes?
The Bible.
The Bible. Can
the
you
Bible.
Sort of narrow it down a little?
Nothing to do with Samson.
Not much.
Not much. A bit, though. No.
Actually, none.
No.
It could be Goliath, because he wasn't.
No.
He was far from refreshed.
No. He was stoned.
It's the Old Testament, not the New.
It's the Old Testament.
Not Adam.
No, not Adam.
Not Adam.
The ants.
Jonathan.
Antonia, I think, is murmuring, if that's the word, from my right.
Psalm.
The Psalms.
I never could sing them, so I won't start now.
Good for them.
What a pity.
Yes, I should run through Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus.
No, the Psalms is right. It is, Antonia has helped you a little bit. It is the Psalms. It's actually Psalm 78, verse 66. So the Lord awaked as one out of sleep, and like a giant refreshed with wine.
Thank you.
One. Dennis, the origin or the derivation, please, of the word propaganda.
Well, isn't that ganda, that Latin, what do they call it? Must be.
Gerund, is it?
The gerund, yes, that's it. The gerund.
The doing thing.
Yeah. It must be done, and from propagate, propago, is it? It must be propagated. Does it come from? Does it work out that way?
It
something
does.
That must be propagated.
It's not actually anything to do with obligation. There's no must actually in the gerund. It just means the act of propagating, or in this particular case, actually things you propagate, like information. Really, it's sort of to propagate means to multiply, and it really means to sort of multiply or to enlarge the idea that you're trying to put over. Anyway, Dennis, you were very, very nearly right. Have a mark and a half.
Right. I'm waiting for you to say take two, they're rather small.
Now for a round of misprinted poetry. There are no misprints in Palgrave's Golden Treasury. But if there had been, what misprints do you think, or what mistakes, what misapprehensions might have resulted? Frank, I would like you to suggest a possible unfortunate misprint.
How about Burns? My love is like a red, red nose. Or break, break, break on the cold grey stones, O.P. Or
I think at this point we will stop and pass on to Dennis.
I was thinking, what was that Lovelace poem? What was her name? On Going to the Wars. Was it Lucasta?
Lucasta.
Stone walls do not a prison make, nor iron bars a cafe. Or Coleridge, in Xanadu did Kubla Khan a stately pleasure dame decree.
Very, very nice indeed. Antonia.
Well, Frank's given me an idea for the song of a man with a seaside allotment. I must go down to the peas again.
Dillis.
Well, I think Milton, with his well-known interest in athletics, mixed up two forms of athletic sport and wrote, they also serve who only stand and skate.
Very nice. Two marks all round. And so we go on to a round of food and drink. With which character, famous in fact, fable, or fiction, can the following refreshments be associated? And why? Frank. Lukewarm water.
What? Lukewarm water. Give me Bartha half a mark for a clue.
Shakespeare.
Narrows it down.
Lukewarm water.
Well, that's... No.
Oh, dear, oh, dear. I confess myself baffled.
You confess yourself baffled?
Yes, indeed.
Can anybody answer this one? I throw it open to the audience, to anybody. It is actually rather a difficult one. Timon of Athens. Well done, sir. Well done. How right you are. Gentleman in the fourth row gets 7 marks. Timon of Athens is perfectly right. He ruined himself by entertaining his friends and then invited them to a banquet where they were offered nothing but lukewarm water. You'll be hearing from the BBC, yeah, sir, in due course.
How did that man get in?
Antonia, broth without any bread.
I'm wondering what the man in the fourth row means. Come to my aid.
Well, it's a lady who's got it.
She gave them some broth without any bread and whipped them all soundly and sent them to bed.
Perfectly right, madam. 7 marks for you, too. This session is deteriorating into panel the audience. I see that. The audience has so far scored 14 marks, which is considerably more than anybody on the platform. You're perfectly right.
French Revolution air.
The tricoteurs.
Yes. We are the masters
knitting away
now.
Yeah. You're perfectly right. It was the old woman who lived in a shoe. Shame on you, Antonio. I thought you'd know that. However, better luck next time. Dillis, here's a tricky one for you. But I think you'll probably get it. Pomegranate seeds. Quiet, audience, quiet. Pomegranate seeds.
The daughter of Ceres.
I knew she would.
What the hell was her name?
She had two, actually. You can have either.
Proserpine?
Proserpine, Proserpine, or Persephone,
Persephone,
if you prefer.
Yes.
What did she have to do with pomegranate seeds?
Well, she was not to eat any, because when she was let out of the lower regions, she was not to eat anything. And if she ate pomegranate, the seeds were left in her mouth, and it was no good. She went back again, didn't she?
You're so nearly right that I cannot possibly withhold from you the marks. What Dr. Lempriere's dictionary has, so it must be true, is what actually happened was that she went down, she was kidnapped
by Pluto
and taken down to the nether regions, and then her mother, who, as you rightly identified as Ceres, went to Zeus and said, "We've got to get her up again. I mean, this is ridiculous." And Zeus tried to say, no, on the contrary, Pluto's terribly nice and make a splendid husband and father. But she wasn't having any. And eventually Zeus said, no, all right, she can come up again as long as she hasn't eaten anything down there. And unfortunately, one morning, strolling through the Elysian fields, she ate some pomegranate seeds. But there were only 6 of them. And so they compromised, and she was allowed to spend 6 months upstairs and 6 months down for the rest of eternity. 2 marks. Well done. Dennis, toasted cheese.
Well, I don't know if it's the one you've got. The one that comes to my mind was the man in... was the castaway in Treasure Island, Ben Gunn, who came to... who dreamed of cheese, mostly toasted.
Perfectly right.
The Spike Milligan version, yes.
Ben Gunn, the maroon pirate of Treasure Island. Now for a quick round of double definitions. What one word has two different meanings which can be defined as follows? Frank, an alumnus and the optical aperture.
Pupil.
Right. 2 marks. Antonia. This is a quick round, you see. Antonia, profoundly wise and an aromatic herb.
Sage.
Perfectly right. 2 marks. Did it. To ingurgitate and a harbinger of summer.
Swallow.
Swallow, perfectly right. 2 marks. Dennis, a fruitful preserve and a vehicular blockage.
Jam.
Jam is perfectly right. 2 marks. Anyway, we come to the last round and Frank and Dennis's quotations. Frank, your quotation, you may or may not remember, was one good turn deserves another.
Yes, well, I'm going to be rich. I'm going to be terribly, really filthy, disgusting rich very shortly because of this song I've written, which is going to absolutely make me a fortune. I was on the beach and we had a portable gramophone and I used to put the record on the gramophone and listen to that lovely sound.
And old Betfridge was sitting on a log. Oh, Mona, finger on his trigger and his eye on a hog. Oh, I'd turn the record over. Hoot the tiger, hoot the tiger. And then my musical taste changed when I had an operatic record, a record by an opera singer. And I bought it cheap because a horse had trodden on it. And I put it on the player. And inefficiently though it played, it made a tremendous impact on me. It was a bass singer, a Russian, who sang. And it was the first time I'd heard that repetition, that repeated theme, which is such a dynamic quality of modern music. And he sang, oh, Chichon, oh, Chichon, oh, Chichon. Oh, Chichon. From the record, I gathered that it was the great Russian bass Charlie Hairpin. And it was, I think, Charlie Hairpin's Oh, Chichon, which got me interested in good singing. And then I bought records by that Italian singer who was wonderful and was immortalized in the, bless you, who was immortalized in the musical show written about him, Gili. Gili. And after him, I was immensely impressed by an Italian baritone whose records came over, Italian tenor. I thought it was so remarkable, a man to have survived so long on a desert island and come back and be able to sing like that, Caruso. I resolved that music would be my life, and my daughter had a piano which she swapped at a school friend for quite a large jar of peanut butter. And it was an imperfect instrument. I couldn't play music. What I did was I wrote the alphabet in black paint on the white notes, going into white paint on the black notes, with capital letters until I ran out of them, and then in small letters. And I found that I could note down. And it's very interesting because the national anthem, when reduced to letters, comes out as My love is like a red, red nose, isn't that unusual? And then it suddenly occurred to me, if I reversed the process, I could compose my song. So I reversed the compose, and I, as it were, fed into the computer. I tapped out on the notes the words of break, 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 on thy cold go cold stones, O.P. And it came out this wonderful tune, which I immediately put words to, and I'm going to sell. It's going to make me a fortune. And then I thought, I'll get Dennis Norton to sing it. Because it is well known that Dennis is to singing what Nureyev is to non-ferrous sheet metal welding. Just to have Dennis singing will make it a sense. And I thought, no. All my life I wanted to write a melody, and I've written one, just one. I will take it to the best. So I'm going to California with it. Because, as the proverb says, one good tune deserves Sinatra.
Your turn, Dennis, now with Little Brown Jug, How I Love Thee.
Well, up until quite recently, if there was one group of middle-aged males I never thought I'd become part of, it was that load of early morning chest thumpers you see pounding round suburban streets in over-elaborate running gear. That I did finally allow myself to be pressured into joining them must, I'm afraid, be blamed on a certain bunch of local troublemakers, my children. Now, the way they exerted this pressure on me was by a constant barrage of comments about my admittedly rather sedentary habits. They'd do things like when they left the room, they would step very ostentatiously over my outstretched legs in the armchair, and they'd say, "No, Dad, don't get up. It's better for you not to get up too suddenly because you might burst a cobweb." Well, because a man can only take so much of that sort of thing, it wasn't long before they got their way. Their only father was driven out into the ranks of those aging dawn sprinters I still privately think of as the Pink Panthers. And do you know something? I'm now glad I let myself be persuaded. I'll tell you why. Whereas formerly my attitude towards joggers could have been described perhaps as amiable derision, once I got involved in jogging myself, once I got that feel of your feet on the rain-swept pavements, that smell of the early morning streets, well, my feeling about it then became quite different. I now absolutely loathe it. I can appreciate, sort of in an intellectual way, of course, that jogging has brought some people a fresh vigour and a whole new zest for living. But what I do know is exactly who those people are now. They are retailers of tracksuits and manufacturers of running shoes. You see, because that's my first complaint about it, the financial outlay. Do you realise that besides the fact that the tracksuit sets you back about 30-odd quid and the running shoes round about 10, besides that, you not only find yourself obliged to spend a good fiver a week extra on deodorants, but also, as though to add even more relevance to the phrase running yourself into debt, you also feel obliged to fork out 6 or 7 quid for one or other of those best-selling jogging instructional manuals you see all over the bookshops nowadays. Don't you find it rather disturbing that man, who's generally reckoned to be the most intelligent species of life on earth, is the only one that needs 90,000 words written down to tell him how to run up and down the street? While even the expense was something I might eventually have come to terms with, the aspects of jogging I just couldn't overcome my aversion to was the time of day it takes place. You see, all my life, dawn has been the hour when I'm at the very lowest point in my biorhythm chart. Body and mind are at their absolute nadir. In fact, on the only occasion when I once found myself obliged to engage in a business meeting at dawn, I arrived wearing only one sock as a tie. And as far as putting myself into any form of sustained physical motion at that time is concerned, the only hope I have of achieving that would be by means of a total body transplant. I think it's sad that my children only began understanding that on the third occasion they had to leave home to come and help me back to the house because I jogged into a manhole. After that, I said, perhaps I can now return to getting all the exercise that my body needs simply by taking Rover out for a walk occasionally. I could see by the expression that they agreed, even though it did mean that Rover would probably get more walks than they thought he deserved. They never did like that tortoise. None of them. They can't say. One thing they cannot say is that I didn't give jogging a try. And having tried, I can now revert to the song so beautifully sung by John Julius Norris, the song that sums up my opinion of it and summed it up right from the start. Little Dawn Jog, How I Loathe Thee.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I see from the score sheet that Frank and Dennis are this week's winners. And so now it's goodbye from Dennis Powell, Antonio Fraser, Frank Muir, and Dennis Norton.
In My Word, the chairman was John Julius Norwich. The questions were compiled by Peter Moore, and the program was produced by Tony Schrein.